From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
State legislators were in their districts for an extended President's Day reprieve this week, but that didn't stop the political wrangling in Albany. I'm Patrick Donges, filling in this week for David Gastina. On today's show, following President Obama's call for a federal minimum wage hike, Governor Andrew Cuomo may be backing off, including a state increase in his final executive budget, to the dismay of legislative Democrats. Our political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok, will provide analysis of Cuomo's latest moves, including what some are calling an expansion of abortion rights in the state. Those stories and more coming up on the Legislative Gazette. The opposition to Governor Andrew Cuomo's New York SAFE Act continued to ramp up this week as one central New York assemblyman has proposed new legislation amending the law to change how assault weapons banned by it are defined. We spoke with 118th District Assemblyman Mark Butler earlier this week about his amendment proposal.
It essentially seeks to modify some of the definitions of what are termed assault weapons in the SAFE Act. There are a number of changes that have made what were, up until a few weeks ago, perfectly legal sporting firearms. Suddenly, overnight, they became weapons that are banned now for sale in New York State. Most of those characteristics that are identified in the bill, or essentially all of them, are really cosmetic. They're things that are part of the gun that really have no effect on its lethality, its power, anything like that. It's just, I'd almost liken it to somebody who gets a car and then, you know, likes to get the extra options on it. It doesn't make the car, more powerful or more dangerous. It doesn't turn it into a racing car. It's still the same basic car, but some people just like to add some extra things to it to make it a nicer car, and such is the case, I believe, with many of these assault-style weapons. Now, the reason that I am pursuing this is that there are several firearms that are made in the Remington Arms plant. I represent a good portion of Herkimer County here, where Remington is located, that are affected by this ban, and I think that sends a tremendously negative message to the ownership of Remington Arms, and as you might well expect, we're quite concerned about the future of that manufacturing plant.
Now, did you hear from Remington specifically on these features that are included in this bill?
I have shared with them the bill, the contents of the bill, have begun a dialogue. We haven't resolved anything, but I was anxious to get this in. If they have some specific concerns about it, I would be willing to entertain that, but they are aware of it, and I did share the contents of the bill with them and am willing to discuss it, which, by the way, I have a sense that the administration did not have any kind of exchange with Remington before coming forth with this bill, which is one of the many frustrations that I see with it.
Some of the features that you had just said you likened to getting the options on a car, the heated seats, if you will, or the like.
Yeah.
We've got a pistol grip, muzzle brake compensator, thumb hole stock, a barrel shroud, those type of things.
Yeah.
Those who lobby nationally for national assault weapons ban and gun control have lists of why these features would make the weapon more dangerous. For example, the pistol grip would facilitate indiscriminate spray firing. A compensator would facilitate more rapid fire. Do you give any credence to those concerns?
I generally dismiss those. The pistol grip, first of all, I think the whole term assault weapon or assault rifle is a bit of an urban myth. I think, you know, certainly you look at the weapon, and there's no question it's evolved from a very specific military design. It looks pretty nasty, and it has a reputation. But there are some distinctions about what these guns are in the hands of sporting sportsmen. Number one, it does not. Automatic weapons are banned. I mean, machine gun style, as you say, spray, have been banned in the United States for decades. These are semi-automatic weapons that we're talking about, which are available in other types of models that are perfectly legal. I'm told, and I'm certainly not a gun expert, but I'm told by people whose opinions I trust that. There are hunting rifles, deer rifles that a typical hunter would have in his gun chest, securely locked up, I might add, that are such much more powerful and have a more hitting power than these weapons. Actually, I would say, as I understand it, the typical AR-15 style, really, it's not something you would even take deer hunting because it just doesn't have what you need. It's more for target shooting, varmint hunting, and primarily for home protection, which I guess is another aspect of this whole thing the governor's overlooked. My district is a very rural district. I have many people who live in very isolated areas, and they like the notion of having a weapon there that they can depend on if the need should arise.
Now, you're looking for co-sponsors in the assembly, I'm reading, and how's that coming?
Well, we are on a break now. A number of my colleagues are probably away on vacation, so I don't expect a lot of progress on that front this week. I did share a draft of the proposed changes with several of my colleagues in the Assembly Republican Conference, and I've already got pledges of support that they will join on. I really think to go anywhere, obviously, we've got to get some support on the other side of the aisle, and I would anticipate that some of the senators that represent this region that is impacted by the employment levels at Remington would be interested in signing on.
That's New York 118th District Assemblyman Mark Butler speaking with the Legislative Gazette on his proposed amendments to the New York SAFE Act. Joining us now, our political observer, Dr. Alan Shartok. Alan, the debate over Governor Cuomo's SAFE Act is continuing. Will this debate end this session?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that I thought it was very courageous of Andrew Cuomo to do this. I think regardless of his motivations, he's been out front on this, and New York now has the first of these state acts, and he beat everybody, including the President of the United States, to it. But I think they may not have been prepared for the ferociousness with which the opponents have come back at them. This is what we call a salient political act, meaning that you only get to cast one vote. So you go into a voting booth and you say, okay, what's the one thing that will make me vote for or against somebody? And when you're a really gung-ho gun owner, quite frequently it is the idea that you're, quote, violating Second Amendment rights or taking away my right to have guns in my house. And I think that they know that. Look, they poll all the time. We know this, the governor's office. So they go out and they do a very interesting thing. They say, how do we counter this? How do we make it better? Well, we could modify the law a little bit to help somebody, as you've just suggested, or we could do something like deal with it by having Governor Cuomo come out and say, here's my Remington's shotgun. I have a shotgun. Everybody says, oh, you know, he's a gun owner. That takes some of the onus off, or is designed to. Then he does a second thing. He announces that he's going to lower the amount that hunters and others have to pay for their licenses when they go to the state of New York. This is a quid pro quo if ever there was one. I mean, he said, okay, I'm in trouble with you guys, but, you know, now you know that I'm a gun toter, and now also I'm going to give you a little break.
So the debate may continue, but he seems to be smoothing out the edges here, is what you're saying.
Well, I think he's trying. I don't think this guy ever sleeps. I think he just worries about, you know, keeping a very high public opinion profile as high as it is now. If you've got in the 70s, any politician around the country would die for it. So this way, you get your cake and you get to eat it too. Or as the Statler brothers once sang, you get your Kate and Edith too.
Speaking of, you mentioned the governor kind of getting out in front of the gun issue, in front of the president even. The president in his State of the Union address calling for a $9 increase to the federal minimum wage. And we had heard from the governor that he would include a state minimum wage increase in his executive budget. But now this week, maybe backing off of that to try and avoid conflicts with both the president and the federal government and other states. Is this a good move on his part?
And one of the others is the assembly. Because as soon as they saw the president of the United States saying $9, they said, okay, we're for $9 too. And I don't think Andrew Cuomo wants to be in a position of being recalcitrant about doing what the president said, which is $9. That's a lot of money. It is clearly a position that Cuomo doesn't want to be in, giving less than the president giving. So I think in the end, they may well do it. Now, the state Senate is the other side of this story. The state Senate in the old days would have said no. You know, we're pro-business, we're Republicans, and we're not doing it. But there's a secret here that most people don't know. And that is that Andrew Cuomo owns the state Senate. He owns it because there are more Democrats in the state Senate than there are Republicans. We all know this. With the election of Cecilia Kacik to the Senate, the Democrats now have more people. But the Republicans are still in control because there is a dissident group under Jeffrey Klein from the Bronx that is thrown a lot in with the Republicans. Let me tell you right now, when Andrew Cuomo wants to pull the plug on the Republicans and say, okay, you guys are going to be banned to the minority for the rest of your lives, they don't want that. The Republicans don't want that. They want to be in control. And when Andrew Cuomo says, okay, look, I know you got to say that you don't want $9. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You guys can go out, you can mouth off all you want, but you got to give me three or four of your votes to make sure that this thing gets through. That's what I predict is going to happen.
And then where does the IDC pan out in that?
Look, they're Democrats, so they have to be for the $9 an hour wage.
We also see this week opponents of the measure in the governor's Women's Equality Act, which he introduced during his State of the State address last month, that would codify women's abortion rights and allow for abortions after the six-month period, which is not in state law but has not been challenged due to federal decisions. Does this bode well for the governor's potential presidential outlook?
Well, look, this governor is very smart. He looked at this last election, saw what women did. They polled like crazy. They know that one of the main reasons that Mitt Romney is not the president of the United States now is that women voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, who was for women's rights on these issues. But I'm fascinated by the act itself because it goes all the way. It says, okay, no more 24 weeks. You can have this thing whenever you want to, basically before you have the kid. Now, that's pretty daring, pretty breathtaking, number one. Number two, you can have this procedure, this abortion procedure, by somebody other than a doctor. Whoa, what's that all about? Well, my idea here is that Cuomo is setting himself up so that he has the maximum flexibility to bargain these issues. So if you say no more 24 weeks, but you could do it right up before the baby is born, and nobody really has seen the bill yet, so we don't really know, that gives you plenty to bargain with. And then second, the idea, which I'm really fascinated by, that others than an MD, maybe nurses, maybe physician's assistants, could do these procedures is interesting in that a lot of people who are physicians are afraid to do this now. People have been killed. People have been, you know, outside their offices and yelling and screaming. So here comes Cuomo and says, okay, if you're going to do that to the physicians, then we're going to let other people besides physicians doing this. What if midwives can do it? So he's set himself up, I believe, with a very strong bargaining position here.
That's Legislative Gazette political observer Dr. Alan Shartok.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm Patrick Donges, sitting in this week for David Gustina. New York State's largest teachers union has filed a lawsuit against the state's property tax cap, claiming that it's unconstitutional. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
New York State United Teachers President Dick Iannuzzi says the cap, passed by Cuomo and the legislature in 2011, arbitrarily limits property tax increases to 2% per year, regardless of whether a school district is wealthy or destitute. The lawsuit also charges that the tax cap violates the principle of one person, one vote, because a supermajority of 60% of voters is required to override a cap. Iannuzzi says at the heart of the court challenge is that the current method of funding schools is not equitable.
The property tax cap and property tax taxes is not the fundamental argument here. The fundamental argument is inequity. And until we address the question of inequity, any legislation that exacerbates that inequity has to be challenged, and that's what we're doing.
The lawsuit argues that a 1980s court decision known as Levittown v. Nyquist allowed the state to have inequitable school funding, but said only if local school districts had the power to control school budgets themselves. Iannuzzi says the tax cap limits that right.
The courts have said it's okay to have inequitable funding as long as you have substantial local control to address the inequitable funding. A property tax cap has taken away that substantial local control.
Since the Levittown decision, the state's highest court ruled in the Campaign for Fiscal Equity decision that all New York school children have the right to a sound basic education and that New York was underfunding schools by billions of dollars. The court's recommendations have never been fully implemented. Governor Cuomo, who counts the property tax cap as one of his top achievements, says the teachers union has a right to sue, but he says more money can't always be the answer. And he says he increased school funding by 4% this year, although in the past, double-digit increases in school aid were common.
We have the most expensive education system in the country. Period. We tried throwing money at the problem. We did it for many, many, many years. We have one of the most expensive and one of the least productive education systems. So the answer that it's more money, more money, more money, I reject.
Cuomo says he thinks steps like establishing teacher evaluation plans will do more to improve education in the state. Brian Sampson with the pro-business group Unshackle Upstate says the tax cap was enacted because the state's property taxes are 78% above the national average, and New York has 9 of the 10 highest counties in the nation for property taxes as a percentage of home values.
Property taxes were becoming a burden and an obstacle to home ownership, but also to the business community.
He says the teachers are trying to avoid making concessions, like giving up some collective bargaining laws that the business group believes favors unions over management. But Sampson says he agrees that there's unfairness in the way school aid is distributed in New York.
The formula in and of itself is flawed.
He says a larger solution might mean wealthier districts have to give up some of their aid to poorer schools. NYSET did get some support for its lawsuit from another union leader. The AFL-CIO's Mario Salento says the undemocratic and arbitrary cap has done nothing but tie the hands of school districts at exactly the wrong time. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
An outside review of New York's $150 billion pension fund for public workers shows it fixed ethical problems that led to a pay-for-play scandal. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The 3-year review by Michigan-based Funston Advisory Services says the Common Retirement Fund's 2009 decision to ban paid placement agents used by other pension funds does not appear to have kept it from accessing qualified outside investment managers. Funston says State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, the fund's sole trustee since a 2007 scandal, is meeting all applicable ethical and conflict of interest standards and is acting solely for the benefit of its 1 million workers and beneficiaries. DiNapoli explains he followed recommendations issued by the Pension Task Force, including tightened oversight of the fund and implementation of major reforms,
including strengthening existing advisory committees, banning pay-to-play practices and use of placement agents, developing new regulations governing the operations of the fund, increasing transparency in our reporting, including issuing monthly transaction reports, publicly announcing estimated pension fund performance on a quarterly basis in addition to the annual reporting that we do of the audited numbers for the pension fund, and expanding vetting, review, and approval of all investment decisions.
Funston conducted its analysis from early September 2012 through January 2013. The review notes the fund is thinly staffed for its size and complexity, depending more on external consultants, and needs better computer infrastructure. The comptroller is satisfied the report identified avenues of positive change.
Certainly the report does identify some opportunities for improvement, such as increasing staff resources, which is something that we certainly plan to do. This will help us pursue opportunities in new or alternative investment areas, finalize our asset allocation in terms of fulfilling some of the goals of that asset allocation, and hopefully have the benefit of reducing some costs. From my point of view, this review is a clear validation that we're on the right path. This is not the end. We will continue to improve our operations and make additional reforms where we need to.
More than 1 million New Yorkers depend on the Common Retirement Fund for their financial security. Frank Morrow with the Fiscal Policy Institute weighs in.
Controller DiNapoli deserves a good deal of credit for undertaking an independent review like this by an outside advisory firm, checking the fiduciary performance and the conflict of interest standards of the fund. I think it's a good step for restoring confidence after some of the problems that occurred in the recent past.
DiNapoli's predecessor, Alan Hevesy, was paroled in December after 20 months in prison for a felony conviction of official misconduct. An attorney general's investigation showed that pension fund officials and cronies, including Hevesy political advisor Henry Hank Morris, got fees and favors from financiers seeking chunks of the fund to manage. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that's all for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of this program are available by calling 1-800-323-9262. That number again is 1-800-323-9262. Just ask for program 1308. You can also stream today's show or download it as a podcast on the web at wamc.org. Join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Patrick Donges. David Gustina will return next week.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.